Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address given at the 2013 Nebraska Book Festival, which took place at the Thompson Alumni Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The guest speaker will be Kurt Anderson, host of Public Radio International and WNYC's Studio 360, heard Saturdays at noon on KIOS-FM, and author of several books, including True Believers, Heyday, and Turn of the Century. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 5, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Book Festival, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The speaker will be introduced by Matt Mason, Nebraska Book Festival coordinator. Here now to introduce the program is Dave Booker, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
As a student of the book myself, having dedicated much of my academic career before becoming things like dean, to studying the works of the 17th century poet and essayist John Milton, I too have a great appreciation for the value of the book. Indeed, Milton himself had lots to say about books, and he keenly himself understood the value of the book, writing in his 1644 essay, Areopagitica, this: "As good almost kill a man as kill a good book. Who kills a man kills a reasonable creature, God's image. But who destroys a good book kills reason itself, kills the image of God, as it were, in the eye." Well, Milton obviously understood what all of us understand about the book. It's a living thing. It's not just this physical, tangible object that we carry around and read. It's a living thing. And it's the product of a living creature. And to disrespect books is to disrespect the people who produce, create, and read them. And so I appreciate the fact that we have an event here to celebrate the value of the book. As we all know, we live in a society that seems to place less and less value on books and humanities, and so it's great that we have an event and events like this that continue to appreciate the value of humanities and the book. The importance of this event, therefore, can't be understated. To celebrate a few of Nebraska's talented writers and their works is to celebrate the lives of both the writers' lives and their works. And, of course, what you're planning for tomorrow, well, by involving high school students, participating high school students, is probably, you know, not to underestimate anything goes on here, probably as much as important as anything that's going to go on here this weekend, because you will be, those of you who are working with them and nurturing them will be helping those students develop their interests and abilities in writing so that someday those students will be the ones perpetuating this event by continuing to carry it on, but they themselves hopefully will be the writers that will be here in the future perpetuating the event, featured as the great Nebraska writers themselves. And that's the most important thing, is to make sure that we continue to celebrate great writing in this great state and at UNO. So thank you all for coming, and I hope all of you have a wonderful festival.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, UNO. This is the first time we've been back here for the book festival in a number of years, so we're very happy to be on campus and in Omaha. Less of a drive for me, for one, but also a good place. All right, but enough of that. We've got a great featured reader tonight who we're very happy to have flying in for a quick trip back to Omaha. He's from Omaha. Right now is on that eastern coast, though. He had a book published in 2012 called True Believers, which was called by Vanity Fair as a great American novel, which is pretty good. It was also on The Washington Post and San Francisco Chronicle named one of the best novels of 2012. And he's, you know, certainly established himself well as a writer for books, for movies, for TV, for stage. He's done quite a bit of work. He's also, I think, particularly well known for Studio 360, a show you can hear on public radio. It's on KIOS on Saturdays at noon, and is won a couple Peabodys, including in 2013, which is pretty amazing. But it's a great program and a great writer. So we're very happy to bring back to Omaha Kurt Anderson. Please welcome him.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. I just realized as the dean was speaking that the first higher education class I ever took in my life was here. Before it was the University of Nebraska at Omaha, when it was the University of Omaha, and they let me take a class here when I was a junior in high school, a history class. So I feel I've come home in a way I hadn't expected. As Matt said, I was born here, grew up here. I spent my first 3 years about a mile and a half, I'm just going to say, that way east? Is that way east? Anyway, mile and a half this way, then spent my next 15 years, 2.5 miles this way. And I grew up surrounded by books. My parents were great readers, and really my memory of my childhood household is books. The only significant renovation my parents did in the 31 years they owned their house on 90th Street was to build more bookcases. And you know, you wonder in the e-book age, what kind of vestigial artifacts bookcases will be in a few decades, but I adored growing up in that household for many reasons. My mother was an amateur Willa Cather scholar, and she worshipped and constantly talked about the great Nebraska writers Lauren Isley and John G. Neihardt. My father, again another serendipitous a connection to this event. My father was an early board member 30-odd years ago when what was then called the Nebraska Humanities Council started, now is Humanities Nebraska, I guess, and which turns out to be one of the sponsoring organizations of this festival. Books were central, as I say, to my life growing up, and as was an attempt a fervent attempt on the part of my parents to inculcate a love of this place. I was really, in a way, incubated all those decades ago to be here tonight by my parents. But they were my parents, which meant what they cared about, I tended not to care about almost on principle. So pretty much as soon as I began reading some of the books that were on the walls of our house and reading about places like New York and Chicago and San Francisco, I really was hatching an escape plan as a child. The summer I turned 10 is when that really hit high gear. We took a long family driving trip to Chicago and New Orleans, which were the first cities other than this one I'd ever been in. And I had kind of an aha moment walking along Bourbon Street in the French Quarter as a 10-year-old past bars and strip clubs. And I realized that I needed to live in a big, noisy, crowded, dirty, urban place when I grew up. And sure enough, I went to college in Boston and moved like a lemming to New York City without a job after I graduated college, which meant and has meant, and now my parents are gone, that I really only learned about and came to really love Nebraska writing and Nebraska culture after I moved away. And so what I'm going to tell you tonight is really the story of the sort of circle I've walked in the last 30-odd years as a writer, finding my way back here, where I'm from, I first discovered a Nebraska writer that I hadn't known, and that if my parents knew about, they never talked about when I was growing up. The poet Weldon Keyes, who had grown up in Beatrice in the 1920s and 30s, and whose father was a well-to-do kid from a well-to-do family because his father was a manufacturer. His father actually manufactured corn huskers, the metal hook with which corn was husked. I found out about Keyes in the 1980s when I was about 30, living in the bohemian, dangerous East Village in New York, wondering if I had it in me to write a novel worth writing. Meanwhile, I became a critic for Time magazine and then for The New Yorker, and I discovered this guy, Weldon Keyes, and his poetry and his biography, and I found that he'd left Nebraska for New York in the late 1930s and become a bohemian and wrote a novel that he had trouble getting published and was a writer for Time and was a writer for The New Yorker, and unlike me, he became a great poet. He was also this extraordinary person. He was kind of the Zelig of mid-century cutting-edge culture. He died mysteriously, probably killed himself, but we don't know, when he was 41. When he died, he was friends with William Carlos Williams, Edmund Wilson, Mary McCarthy, Saul Bellow, Dwight MacDonald, Alan Tate, Lionel Trilling, Willem de Kooning, Robert Motherwell, Hans Hoffman, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Pauline Kael, among others. So he they were friends with him partly because he was such an extraordinary poet, a poetry, obviously, bred in Nebraska. Next, I discovered the books of my keynote speech predecessor here last year, Ron Hansen, who was born and raised in Omaha. I read in my early 30s when I was inching toward writing, well, more to the point, publishing, trying to write publishable fiction. I read three of his novels, Desperados, about the Dalton Gang, and The Assassination of Jesse James, about Jesse James, and a book, wonderful book called Hitler's Niece, again, self-explanatory. But these extraordinary historical novels were really key in deciding me to, making me decide that I would write an historical novel, and then, in fact, two historical novels of the ones I've written so far, because he did it in a way, again, my parents were great readers of historical novels, but I therefore rejected the idea of historical novels until I read ones fantastic enough on my own to embrace the genre. And, of course, when I discovered Ron Hansen, I wasn't supposed to like Ron Hansen because I went to West Side, he went to prep. same thing goes for Rick Dooling, a prep graduate, who is my age exactly, and whom I didn't know, and I first read in The New Yorker about almost 20 years ago, this strange, great, weird, funny short story called Bush Pigs. I just happened to be reading the magazine and came across this story by a name I didn't know about a Peace Corps volunteer evacuated from Sierra Leone back home to Omaha, where he meets his best friend at the airport named Kurt, K-U-R-T. So I thought, wow, kismet. We didn't meet actually until 5 years later in person in New York, near my office at the Algonquin Hotel. We thought, oh, we're writers, let's meet at the Algonquin Hotel. And as it happened, the day we ended up having a drink together I had literally just gotten by fax, so it was a while ago, by fax, the copy of the first review of my first novel. And so I got to share that with his great, generous spirit, a guy who'd been through it already, because he is a terrific novelist and was several ahead of me even then. But it was a nice way to forge a friendship with another Nebraska novelist. Then I became close friends, very close friends, had dinner with him last night in New York with the writer Michael Ripps, also my age exactly, also an Omahan whom I hadn't known growing up somehow. Michael is a lawyer, but he writes these brilliant, again, peculiar, funny memoirs, and his second one, which you may know, is called Face of a Naked Lady, an Omaha Family Mystery. And he describes a world that, and a life, even though same city, exactly the same years, But we lived, obviously, in parallel universes, I discovered from reading this memoir of his. I was sort of in the Leave It to Beaver, Omaha, and he was in the Twin Peaks, Omaha. His first book was called Pasquale's Nose, and if I hadn't known Michael by then, it's this story of his year with his wife and his child in this little strange little town in Italy. If I had just come across this ostensibly nonfiction book, I would have said this is fiction disguised as nonfiction. As it happens, I spent a week with my wife and I and our children spent a week with them in this unbelievably strange little town in Italy, and it's absolutely nonfictional. And I realized that he simply is either strange. He is a magnet for strangeness, or vice versa. I don't know which. In 2005, a Nebraskan I didn't know wrote me out of the blue and asked if I'd come to a books and writers festival that he was organizing down in the old market. I did. And not only did Timothy Shaffert and I thereby become friends, but I had yet another Nebraska novelist whose books I adored and had to read. He writes these great, mostly short novels with really long titles that thus far have all been set in the state of Nebraska: Coffins of Little Hope, Devils in the Sugar Shop, The Singing and Dancing Daughters of God, and I'm dying to read his new one, which is set in Omaha during the Trans-Mississippi Exposition, which was, of course, the 1898 World's Fair. And this is how these connections kept happening as I was somehow found myself reversing course or stepping back home. Timothy introduced me to what is now my favorite used bookstore on earth, the Jackson Street Booksellers on 11th Street. And down in the old market on the same day, he introduced me to that. He introduced me also to Megan Daum, who was a New Yorker who had pretty randomly decided to move from New York to a farmhouse outside Lincoln and lived there for 4 years, inspired by which she published a lovely novel called The Quality of Life Report. So I think she counts as a Nebraska writer, even though she now lives in Los Angeles. Also, I think through Timothy as well, I met the wonderful writer Therese Svoboda, who grew up in Ogallala, and whose fantastic, maybe not most recent novel because she's disgustingly prolific, but a recent novel about 19th century Nebraska called Bohemian Girl, I love so much that I offered to say so on the cover of the book. Ditto with the books of one of your faculty here, John Price, who teaches English and writing and is, in fact, teaching the nonfiction writing workshop here tomorrow. John writes wonderful memoir about family and aging and love and this place. This place, broadly construed, because he lives in Western Iowa and he writes a lot about Iowa, and I grew up with bigotry only against Western Iowa. Really was the only prejudice I was given by my parents. But anyway, he's a lovely, lovely writer about the land and being a human today, these very bittersweet celebrations of this American zone. So Nebraska just keeps pulling me back. One day in Manhattan, a few years ago, I was outside in front of the building where I record my radio show and minding my own business, ordering a sandwich at this little kiosk. And this young woman next to me spoke to me, and she said she was Rachel Jacobson, and she worked in the station with me, and I said, "Nice to meet you. I'm having lunch." And she said she was from Omaha, and she had this dream she wanted to talk to me about, to return to our hometown and start a nonprofit movie theater that would show amazing films that didn't otherwise get shown in Omaha. And I basically said, "Good luck with that." And but she invited me to help her, and I did my little best to help her, and. As I'm sure you know, or you should if you don't, she has done. She's amazingly made good on that dream with film streams beyond at least my, if not her, wildest dreams. And I have been again. I've returned more than once as part of the film streams family, and through my now great friend Rachel Jacobson, I became friends finally with the great film director and writer Alexander Payne. Yet another Creighton prep grad of my generation, whom I'd had to wait and been gone for two or three decades in order to meet. And then, in the course of a project I was doing for Film Streams, I discovered this amazing piece of Nebraska history that I had never known anything about, and I suspect that most of you don't either. Back in the 1930s and 40s, there was a filmmaker from Texas named Melton Barker. What Melton Barker spent his entire career doing from about 1930 to into the early 50s was traveling from town to town to town all over the country, making a movie, making the same movie over and over and over again. It was a two-reeler, 22-minute movie called The Kidnapper's Foil. What Melton's genius was, he would go into the town, sign up all the especially the children, but townspeople in general, to be in the movie, shoot the movie, and then show it for as long as people would buy tickets in the town and surrounding thing. The Kidnappers, there are versions of The Kidnapper's Foil shot in Grand Island, in Hastings, in Kearney, in Norfolk, in Fremont, in Nebraska City, and Columbus, among others. Most of this was in 1938. I just found myself fascinated by this. I had just become entranced by Melton Barker's story and time in Nebraska when the Library of Congress, an editor there called me and asked if I'd be interested in writing the text for a book they were publishing. And it's part of a series of books about the lesser-known great photographers of the WPA era who the government sent around the country to document the Depression, the Great Depression. They wanted me to write the text for this book about a guy called John Vachon, who is a great photographer, but as I say, little known. And I looked at some of the pictures, and I liked them a lot. I resisted the assignment. They weren't paying me a lot of money. I always have too much to do. I didn't have time. But I did a little research, and I found out early on in my little research, before I thought I was going to tell them, I don't have time, that Vachon's first serious assignment at age 24 was a month-long trip to Nebraska. So I was hooked and spent much more time than I should have researching and reading about and writing about John Vachon. So in the fall of 1938, Vachon travels from Washington, D.C., where he lived and worked in the office of the Farm Security Administration that sent out all these photographers, and really, as a 23-year-old, had sort of invented the mission statement for what they were doing, documenting the Great Plains, especially in the South and the West. During the Depression, he takes the train all the way out to North Platte, and he wrote a letter to his wife from North Platte. It was the first and only Nebraska town I've been in that sold liquor over the bar. And North Platte, I've been to North Platte. I passed through North Platte more than once growing up. It was, in 1938, the vice capital of the Great Plains. It was called Little Chicago because it was so nasty and dirty. Who knew? Anyhow, on the night of October 28th, 1938, just before Halloween, he walks into a place called the Alamo Bar and wrote his wife about that. I got pretty plastered on great gobs of beer in the line of duty. At the piano was a big, huge, large, fat blonde woman of 45 to 50 years with beautiful, smeary red makeup on her puss. And then, according to a letter written the same day to his boss, he identified the woman as Mildred Irwin, who was an ex-Omaha prostitute and very proud of it and played only very nasty songs. So I told her I was a Broadway scout and would like to take her picture. Of course, she thought it was a swell idea. His pictures are extraordinary, and this book is called Fields of Vision, the photographs of John Vachon. It's a lovely book of pictures. So back in Lincoln, as he's heading back, he spends some time in North Platte and then stops in Lincoln on the way. He rents a car, drives west into Seward County, just wandering around looking for pictures to take. And on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere, he finds this perfectly beautiful, innocent, dignified 10-year-old girl, the sort of opposite of what he'd shot two nights earlier, named Claudine Abiel, sitting on the ground near her parents' farm, and made this amazing photograph, which, when I saw it, I kept thinking, why is that so familiar? And I realized it looks just uncannily like the most famous painting by Andrew Wyeth, Christina's World, of Christina sitting on the hill in Maine, which was painted 10 years later. And I wonder if, why, I mean, he became Vachon, you know, a successful photographer, and his pictures were published. So I wonder if Wyeth saw this picture of this Nebraska girl. And in fact, I heard from her grandchildren after this book came out, which was kind of lovely. Anyhow, Vachon goes back to Lincoln after making this great picture, where he took a picture of this grocery store. Kodachrome film was brand new. It had only come out 3 years ago, so it's a pretty extraordinary color picture. I love this picture so much I have it as the picture that is my Facebook page, essentially. Then he comes up to Omaha, where he spends a whole week walking and walking and walking. He says he walked 100 miles. I doubt it, but he walked a lot, shooting hundreds of pictures, about 200 of which are in the Library of Congress archive. 36 years later, John Vachon said, "It was in Omaha that I realized I'd developed my own style with the camera. I knew I'd photograph only what pleased me or astonished my eye, and only in the way I saw it. Omaha did it." So, and what's so great about these pictures, and what in a way this strikes me as what's so great about this place in a lot of ways, is the iconic, familiar images of the Depression by his older colleagues like Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange, we've all seen a million times. But the unfamiliarity of his images from this same period, as skilled as the more famous ones, are just are astonishing. They're so, because they're so fresh, it's more like a sort of time travel experience rather than seeing once again the pictures that one, the gorgeous, familiar, iconic images one has seen. They are also, those pictures like the one on Douglas, for me they had great resonance because I thought, well, Central High School, my mom was a senior in high school as this picture was being taken. And in fact, then I found a picture that he'd taken, not a great picture, but it was amazing to me because it said Central High School students walking down Dodge Street. And I got a loop and I looked for a picture of my mother. Alas, I didn't find it. But so out of these, and how does this relate to books? Not just because I wrote an essay in a book, but out of finding out about John Vachon and his trip to Omaha, Nebraska in 1938, finding out about Melton Barker and his trip to Nebraska, I suddenly thought, I officially felt the jitter that says there's a germ of something here. There's a germ of a novel or a screenplay or something to write here. It is on my stack of ideas. I'm definitely going to write about, if not Melton Barker and John Vachon, people very much like them in 1938 in Nebraska. And then I realized Nebraska and Omaha specifically has appeared in all of the novels I've written already. Omaha of the 1950s and 1960s appear in two of them in disguised fashion. In the most recent book that Matt mentioned, True Believers, I make it a suburb of Chicago, partly for story reasons, because they needed to be near Chicago, but also because it's fiction. You're supposed to make it different than what it really is. And the other, my first novel, Turn of the Century, it's a suburb of Minneapolis that the character leaves as the character in True Believers left the suburb of Chicago. But it's really Omaha. But in my novel, which is set in 1848, called Heyday, the characters, the main part of the story involves them traveling from New York City to this small town suddenly becoming a city, San Francisco, in 1848. So I had to make them stop here, I figured. Of course, Omaha didn't exist. Where we are now was not even yet part of the United States of America, not even a territory. The Omaha Indians, of course, did exist, and so I have them appear in the novel. And although Council Bluffs was not yet called Council Bluffs, there was a thriving, huge, temporary Mormon community there, and I have a pivotal scene in that novel happen there because by this time I'd realized I can flaunt my love of Omaha and Nebraska and put it in any book I want. And finally, earlier this year, the fiction editor, just a couple of months ago, the fiction editor of Esquire asked me, Esquire magazine asked if I'd write a short story for a special issue they're doing, a whole bunch of stories around the theme of how to be a man. And I'd had an idea for a while that I thought would work for this, and I just finished it. The only, other than the theme, the only rule was that it couldn't be longer than 800 words, so it's a very short story. It is set in Lincoln, and as you'll see, it had to be set in Lincoln. My wife has read it, the editor has read it, and no one else has read it or heard it, but now it's short. I'm going to read it for you. It's called Young Strangers. More than any other church in Lincoln, St. Mary's was a building people tended to treat as a public space, a general gathering spot for events that weren't christenings, weddings, or funerals. That's because it was big and old and downtown, right across K Street from the Nebraska State Capitol, because it didn't serve liquor so kids could come, and because it was Catholic, which in the middle of the 20th century made it a kind of Switzerland for Protestants, made Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians and Baptists more comfortable than they would have been at a church of a Protestant denomination not their own. And so Lincolnites of all sorts would assemble in St. Mary's basement to play bingo, listen to polka bands, watch ventriloquists, whatever. The day after Thanksgiving in 1952, St. Mary's put on a macaroni buffet dinner and variety show, $1.50 a ticket. It sold out. The main attraction was an actual celebrity, a young guy who hosted his own afternoon TV show up in Omaha for a couple of years since graduating from the University of Nebraska. Kids made up half the audience, including exactly one who'd come all by himself, a wiry little 16-year-old radiating eagerness as he rushed to get a chair in the front row. A few months earlier, this boy had won the Best New Performer Award at the National Magicians Convention in St. Louis. The guy about to appear on stage was pretty much exactly the man he wanted to become, a Nebraskan who'd graduated from college and was plainly on his way to a coast, a funny magician, and a TV star, local TV, but still. Plus, whoa, the mimeograph program said he'd been a champion boxer in the Navy during the war. The kid, a Lincoln High junior people called Dick, was a gymnastics star. As he settled in, preparing to take notes, he didn't notice the boy three chairs away in the front row, a Lincoln High freshman on a rare night out with his big family, celebrating his 14th birthday. They were up front because poor Charlie, in addition to his bowed legs and funny way of pronouncing S's, was badly nearsighted. Charlie glanced over at the twerp upperclassman with his notebook and thought, "Goddamn Gallant." A popular girl in his class this fall had started calling Charlie Goofus, the bad boy opposite to Goody Goody Gallant in the Highlights for Children comic strip. The show began, and when the Omaha TV guy bounced on stage, Charlie envied him his comfort, his easy smile, his cool, and his fame. Another kid named Richard, a sixth grader, was in the fourth row with his dad and little brother and sister and fun-loving mom. His mom had briefly been a local celebrity herself, semi-professional championship-based softball team 3 years running, and worked for the state health department across the street. Little Dickie, intelligent but literal-minded, didn't quite understand the joke about Adlai Stevenson losing the presidential election 3 weeks ago, or why his dad, who'd voted for Stevenson, was laughing out loud at it. Laughing even louder were four people sitting together in the sixth row, the former state attorney general, his wife, and their 24-year-old son, a University of Nebraska graduate, a lawyer back home from Washington, D.C. for the Thanksgiving holiday with his wife. The father, still smiling at the joke, whispered, asking his son if he'd ever seen this guy perform when they were at the university together, to which Ted answered no, but that he reminded him a little of his new boss. The biggest, squawkiest laugh at the political joke came from near the back of the room, from another recent University of Nebraska alumnus, another son of a maverick Republican politician, another young up-and-comer who'd spent time on the East Coast trying to make his mark. He worked as a stockbroker for his dad in Omaha, but he'd recently bought a gas station as an investment and had driven down to Lincoln for the night to look at some other small businesses that a college friend, a member of the St. Mary's congregation, wanted him to go in on. He didn't drink, and the prospect of such a cheap night on the town, dinner and a show for a buck and a half, had been irresistible. In other words, of the 10,287 males between the ages of 6 and 27 in Lincoln, Nebraska that night in 1952, 37 were in the basement of St. Mary's Catholic Church, full of macaroni and jello salad, laughing and applauding at jokes and tricks. And 6 of those 37 became famous men, which is to say, the comedian and talk show host Johnny Carson was on stage, and in the audience were the future comedian and talk show host Dick Cavett, Charles Starkweather, the future mass murderer, Dick Cheney, the future vice president of the United States, Theodore Stevenson, the future special counselor and speechwriter to President Kennedy, and Warren Buffett, the future billionaire. And it was a good magic show. So thank you. Thanks. During the question period, if you have questions about to what degree that is based on reality, I'm happy to answer those questions. Nowadays, I live in New York, and not a week goes by when I don't think of Nebraska, not just of my parents and growing up, but of particular sense memories of growing up here. There are, and this sounds strange when I say it to my friends in New York, but there are many sort of perfectly clear blue sky afternoons when where I live in Brooklyn is not particularly crowded with people on the streets, and some afternoons I'm like the only person walking down my block, and I think of Saturday afternoons as a kid walking around downtown Omaha, where I would take the bus alone just to be around this different urban place full of old stone buildings, and I really feel for a second at a time that I'm a 12-year-old kid in Omaha. And whenever I'm driving around the country and I hear a train whistle, I think of the weekends always that I spent with my grandparents in Valley, Nebraska, a little town west of here. And the first sense of what I understood to be melancholy that I ever felt by hearing the train whistle as I was sitting alone in this little town with my grandparents at age 10 or 11 and hearing the train whistles there, I was excited by it. I was made a little sad by it. And those sort of long, peaceful days in which it was before the age of play dates and overscheduled children, and I just read and listened to train whistles in Valley, Nebraska. So and the other thing I often think of unprompted, because it was such my first most intense olfactory memory was in Valley, Nebraska, that there was this regularly this rich, almost stench-like, but kind of wonderful smell of which turned out to be, my father told me when I was young, alfalfa being dried, roasted, I don't know what you call it, but heated up and made this scent of alfalfa over the whole town. And I really, it's for one reason or another, I think of that smell a lot. And all of these sense memories will, sooner or later, make their way into some fiction I will write, perhaps this story of the itinerant, cynical filmmaker meeting the earnest, young Depression photographer. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying is that I spent my first 18 years pretty much bound to leave Nebraska, and I've spent the last 40 years coming back, literally and figuratively, and turning finally into a Nebraska writer. Thank you very much. Thanks. And as you can tell, I've not given this talk elsewhere, because I don't know that people other than people at the Nebraska Book Festival would be interested in it. But I was so pleased that I actually went to time. Matt said 45 minutes. I was 45 minutes. So I'm obedient. If there are any questions about anything I've ever done, I'm happy to ask them.
This is not so much a question as a comment. I believe those are the grain elevators at about 32nd Street and Interstate 80, and they have now been graced by the addition of 26 murals that are in the form of banners that are affixed to the elevators. So they look a lot better now.
Really?
Yeah.
I think they look pretty great then, myself. I remember there was a grain elevator in like around 72nd Street when I was growing up that I always I took as normal. But as I got older, I realized, why is there this agricultural industrial thing like right in the middle of where people are living? In 1938, they loved it without the murals. Like, that's all I know.
I was wondering about your drafting process. When Joanne Beard visited campus, she says she hates writing or rewriting and tries to get it all down in the first or second take. And Dinty Moore also came on campus and said he writes and rewrites and rewrites. And so within that range, I was wondering if you could share your process.
Sure. In the digital age, when writers talk about how much they revise and how much they rewrite, it's hard to know if apples and oranges are being compared, you know? It used to be you'd type out your draft and then you'd literally then, you know, have a draft, you'd retype it. And so it was, we were all comparing apples to apples. So I wonder about this myself. When I'm writing fiction, I don't just slam it out. Not that it's perfect when I finish a day's work of writing, but I need it to be unembarrassing. And I'll come back the next day and think maybe. But I am a relatively speaking a slow writer and go slowly so that when I get to the end, yes, it still needs to be cut, changed, rewritten, worked, but when I get to the end, you know, it's imperfect, and there's another year of work to do, or 6 months, or a year of work to do on a book, but it's not a rough draft. So I feel I rewrite a sentence or a paragraph many, 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 many times during the course of an hour or a day, but going from and then when I have a draft done, I go from page one and fuss and rewrite and take things out and move things around over and over and over again. But in terms of like numbers of drafts or rewrites, it's hard for me to say. But I'm certainly on the slower end of that spectrum than the faster one.
There's no chance in hell of you retiring here, is there?
Because it's so warm or what? No. I like it here a lot, and I would in my ideal world, I've said to my wife, I said, if we could figure out a way to be the right couple of months in Omaha, the right few months in Los Angeles, and then 6 months in New York, you know. And by retiring, do you mean I'm old? Is that what you're saying? No, I like coming back, and I really, you know, I wrote a piece about Omaha and its cultural effusions and efflorescence a few years ago in the New York Times, and realized as I was, you know, talking to all these people creating these various cultural scenes here and great institutions, that I wonder how the 18-year-old me today would regard this city differently. So, but. To the point of retiring here? No, I don't know. Make me an offer. No.
In the 80s and 90s, I worked for the Humanities Nebraska, and I knew your parents, and I just loved them. I remember visiting with them at a Chautauqua in Broken Bow extensively. They were big Chautauqua fans.
Yes, they were.
What would they say to you today, and what would you say to them?
Oh, gosh. Look, I'm back. I like this place, okay? I don't know. My father died fairly young in 1988. My mother lived another 15, 16 years. What I'm happy about is, to the point of tonight and this weekend, my mother... got to see two of my books, novels, come out, and so that made her happy, and it made me happy that she was happy. It also, to the point of one writers, fiction writers using people they know, I put a character that I based quite a lot on my mother in my first novel, And I was worried, like, how is she going to deal with this? She had no clue. And I didn't tell her. So maybe I would tell her that. I don't know. I would tell them thanks. When artists and comedians and performers, people, and I interview a lot of them on the radio show, you know, talk about, and it's a cliche that artists had these difficult, troubled childhoods that their work is now a means to deal with and escape. I had a perfectly wonderful, great childhood. I got no complaints, which isn't to say I didn't, you know, have the misbehave and have the fights one has with one parents, but I would tell them, thank you for being my parents and having all those books around and all that music around and having, you know, encouraging us to have arguments at dinner with you about whatever we were having arguments about in the 1960s. And I would say and my wife, who didn't know them until we were no longer children, says the same thing, that they are our models for if we can raise our children half as well as they seem to raise their four children, then we'll be happy. But, you know, well done, Mom and Dad, is what I would say, and thank you.
Thanks for coming back to Omaha.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm wondering if you are the Kurt Anderson...
No.
Who Tony Hendra mentions in his book.
Yes. Well, so, how does he mention me? But
I
yes.
I don't know if it would be the same
Kurt. I know. I'm a friend of Tony's.
You are? Okay. Yes. Well, it's got to be the same. He's speaking of Meet Mr. Baum.
Oh, yeah.
It had been written by humorists like Bruce McCall and Kurt Anderson. And as its editor, I was pretty proud of it. I didn't know if he was a good bit older than you and I and some of the people in the
room.
He's
a lot older than
me. A lot older.
No, Tony is a great humorist. Here's how old Tony is. Tony was a comedian on the Ed Sullivan Show in the early 60s. Yes. He came to America from Britain as a comedian, as part of a two-man comedic team. And then, I don't know, overstayed his visa and never left. And
this book isn't, you probably know this book then, Father Joe.
Oh, I do indeed, yeah.
This isn't about him, as you know, but he's in it about every other page.
Yes.
Because it's about what Father Joe did for him.
Correct.
So his professional career in its many different aspects and his slips and falls and regaining his footing and falling again and finally, I guess he might even say getting salvation.
I think he would.
Was thanks to Father Joe. But in the meantime, here's Jonathan Miller and Peter Cook.
Right.
And this is Spinal Tap and all these names that are...
No, I'm happy to be... it's nice of him to give me a shout-out.
Yeah, well, I've been wondering since I read it if it was the same... Well,
that's me. Anderson with an E.
I don't want to highlight age differences, but I just realized that you left... You left Omaha in 68?
72. And I didn't graduate college until 76. 76 is the year I feel as though I left. I didn't come back for summers anymore.
And when I was a kid, I went to, I was in Cambridge a lot. I grew up in the Boston area, and my father was a university professor. There was lots of anti-war protests. And since True Believers, your latest novel, deals a lot with someone of a certain age, having to deal with what she did when she was 17 and involved in anti-war activities, I was wondering whether you are working from any personal experience with the anti-war movement or not.
No, and as she makes clear, and because she narrates the novel, she is she's 5 years older than I, and that 5 years in exactly that sense made all the difference. Which is to say she was 18 years old, 19 years old in 1968, and I was 13 years old, you know, and 14 years old. So I went to an anti-Vietnam thing in Elmwood Park once at age 16, and I went to something in 1970 in Lincoln after the invasion of Cambodia, but no. I mean, I was a little kid. So I was just, but I was just too young. So no personal experience in that sense, although... Again, as a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old at that time, I was a junior auxiliary member of the anti-war counterculture, I suppose. But no, she is an imaginary figure in terms of the anti-war criminality in which she engages. I engaged in different forms of criminality as a teenager, but they were not. I wouldn't call it a protest in any sense.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I just finished reading Annie Dillard's wonderful memoir called An American Childhood, about growing up in Pittsburgh. And she talks about such love of her city, and she has such wonderful memories of growing up there. And I wondered if you ever thought of writing just a memoir about actually growing up in Omaha rather than a novel.
To the point of, and are you going to retire here? Memoirs still strikes me as something that somebody maybe a little older than I do. Although, you know, look at John, look at Michael Ripps. You know, youngish people can write memoirs too. I have thought about writing memoir. I mean, I will tell you, I'm now old enough that, you know, I start thinking in terms of, okay, I got this many years. How many books can I write, and what are they going to be? So the upside of that is it's now a manageable space of time to plan, rather than being this endless highway of time. So I might do that. I don't know that I would write a memoir just about growing up here. I think that would be, other than people in this room, I don't know that people would be interested in that. But as I indicated, my memories and sense of this place, it's like a time release thing that gets more and more and more intense the older I get. So if and when I write a here's my life memoir, growing up in Omaha would absolutely be a large part of it.
I'm a big fan of your radio show.
Thank you.
And every Saturday afternoon, I think, how did he get this incredible gig? Because it just seems like such a blast. So if you could talk a little bit about the inception of the show.
It is. I ask myself that not every Saturday afternoon, but often as well. It's strange because I was not a radio person. I had appeared on been on radio sometimes talking about stuff or books I'd written or whatever, but I'd never hosted a show. So in 1999, I published my first novel and in fact was at the New York Public Radio Station, WNYC, and sitting around waiting to be interviewed about it. And I saw like a job posting for this new show that they wanted to start. And I didn't then apply for it, but I saw it. So I was aware of it. And then not long after that, a few months later, I got a call out of the blue from the Public Radio International, which is the entity that produces it and distributes it, saying, we want to do some kind of hour-long show a week about culture. We think you'd be a good host. And at first... because it had happened to me once before, I thought they had the wrong Kurt Anderson as this lady who, in Tony Hendra's book, wasn't sure it was the right Kurt Anderson. No, I once was called by a theater director saying, is this Kurt Anderson? Yes. I would love you to be in our off-Broadway production of Othello. Really? As what? As Othello? And it turned out there was a great African-American actor named Kurt Anderson that he thought he had called. Anyway, so I thought maybe they had the wrong person, and they didn't, and I tried out, and some other people tried out, and they decided to give it to me, and then, blessedly, we had a year to sort of invent it and figure out what it would be, and I had a year to learn at least the basics of the craft of how to not sound like an idiot on the radio, and learn to not hate my voice in recorded form. It's been an amazing run. It is by far now, I mean, twice as long as the next longest gig I've ever had. So I feel like uh, I'm I'm really running on luck at this point. It's gigantic fun because it came after I had reconstituted myself as not a guy who goes into a job, but somebody who writes books at home. I was able to then. So I write in the morning and do the radio and other stuff in the afternoons. And so I was able to sort of form that around my existing life. And so it's you know, after sitting alone in a room making stuff up for a few hours, it's nice to go to a place and with these very talented producers and get to talk to my heroes, you know, musicians, artists, writers. And then the dirty little secret of radio, and I know this is being recorded for radio, but I'll still say it, is it's so much easier than writing. It is because, yeah, I have to read the books and see the plays, tough duty, and do research but then last week, so the job was having a conversation with Tom Hanks for an hour, say goodbye, and my producers cut it into a nice 15-minute piece. I mean, it's hard work in a sense, but it is really so much easier than what I spend the rest of my life doing. So I feel like it is more of a glorious gig than anybody has a right to have. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. If we've heard the keynote address given at the 2013 Nebraska Book Festival, which took place at the Thompson Alumni Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The guest speaker has been Kurt Anderson, host of Public Radio International and WNYC's Studio 360, heard Saturdays at noon on KIOS-FM, and author of several books, including True Believers, Heyday, and Turn of the Century. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 5th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Matt Mason, Nebraska Book Festival coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.